All right, folks, we are back on the flagstick.com Tea Talk podcast. Stefan Tiedorf here with my co-host, as per usual, the one and the only, Scott McLeod. How are you today?
I'm doing great, buddy. Happy belated birthday. Turned a big 31 on the weekend, so congrats to you. And 31, you're catching up to me.
Yeah, I'll never fully catch up, but
I hope
one
not.
Day, I'm just hoping to beat you one day on the golf course. I think you'll have to be 70 for me to pull that off. I might not even have a shot then. Our new segment we started up a few weeks ago. It's the What Are You Drinking for the podcast segment. You know, we're heading into winter, so we gotta fight through these cold winters. And we're Canadian. We like a beverage to get us through that. So, Scotty, what are you drinking today?
I've got a little Kilkenny Irish Cream Ale. So lovely, perfect for the fall, getting into the winter. Not quite Guinness, but a little darker, a little smoother. Always good for this time of year.
I love that call. I'm definitely, give me the dark beers, the stouts in the winter. Just warms you up on a cold winter night. Give me the kind of the fruitier beers in the summer. I'm all for that. However, today I have a Red Breast Irish Whiskey brewed in New York. Yeah. A little bit of sherry taste into there, oaky taste. So I'm going a little stronger, needing to warm up even more. I'm down in the basement. You're up in your office there, or, you know, the corner of your daughter's bedroom or wherever.
I think this is my daughter's office. Mine is downstairs. So.
There you go.
Yeah, she gets two rooms in the house. We get one, right?
Yeah, that's how it works. That makes sense, right?
Yeah. Well, actually probably have to talk about that a little bit more as we get into the season. We can maybe talk about a few of the different scotches and stuff like that. And yeah, it's always a fun thing because it's something I'm into.
We could just get rid of golf and we could just like do a scotch tasting podcast. And then like every once in a while, I'll be like, yeah, Tiger played. And then people might listen better, more. I don't know. Where do you want to start this week? There's a little bit of golf happening on the weekend. Nothing that super, super entertaining. For me, I'm thinking Mickelson going 2-for-2 on the Champions Tour. Is this just where his game is at this point that, you know, he can easily compete out there and it's going to need to have everything come together at the exact same time for him to even be, you know, in the mix come Sunday?
Yeah, I think this is a guy who obviously has the skills to compete on the regular tour and then transferring that over to the Champions Tour where the golf courses are definitely a little bit more friendly. You know, they're set up for entertainment to allow a lot of birdies. I mean, this is a guy who swings at 180 miles an hour going out and, you know, beating it. His ball speed's 180 miles an hour going against some guys that are working around the golf course at 140 miles an hour. So, you know what? As long as he's playing, he's probably going to be in the mix for any tournament that he plays in. But, you know, this weekend was a little bit more entertaining. Richmond, Virginia, they were playing a Dominion Energy Charity Classic, and it was two lefties in the mix, including our Mike Weir, obviously well known to Canadian fans, but also an eight-time winner on the tour, Masters champion, and the two of them, you know, heading off against each other. But Mickelson got the best of them on Sunday.
Yeah, and he should.
You'd think so, yeah.
He should, based on the game. His game kept up right until 50. You know, he was in the mix. You know, it wasn't that long ago. He won a couple of years ago. He won on the PGA Tour. Mike, you know, we like Mike. Great guy. He's had time for both you and I at some point. More you in his career. But, like, you know, his game, he was fighting just to get here, right? And that's the main difference, that Phil should be competing. He doesn't want to be out there. Phil was got into the CJ Cup or whatever at Shadow Creek, he would have been there if he got into it, but he didn't. So, you know, I think a lot of people want to know our thoughts on Weir, though, being in the mix. I think it's a good thing. I'd love to see Weir carve out a career on the Champions Tour. I am worried, though, because a lot of these guys that are just turning 50 that have been grinding to get there, they were maintaining those high clubhead speeds that they had at their younger ages, where Mike never really was that in the first place.
Yeah, but you know, he's not as short as people might think he is. I mean, obviously compared to Mickelson, it's a different story. But you know, Mike's a guy who can still get it out there 290, but he can score. And we saw that in the second round. I mean, their first round was washed out on Friday. So they had to play 36 holes on Saturday. And you know, he was 13 under for those 36 holes, including a 63, a 9 birdie bogey free 63. So, you know, this is a tour where he can compete and do well. The issue is that if Phil is competing that week, it makes it a lot harder. And I think the difference between the two, and no disrespect to Mike Weir, because obviously a great champion, you know, 8-time winner versus a 44-time winner, 5-time major champion versus a 1-time major champion. But you know, if you think about where their games are at right now, you know, Mickelson is a legitimate contender at the Masters coming up at 66-1.
Is he?
And, you know, not a well, you know, more legitimate as far as from a betting odd standpoint, whereas Weir is a 2,000-1, you know, long shot that's there. So yeah, you know, maybe Mickelson's not going to tear it up with the, you know, the best players on the PGA Tour at this point. He's going to contend with him. Will he get more wins? I don't know. It'd have to be the right event for him to do that. But when he comes into this, he's the 7-footer playing with 6-footers in a lot of games.
That's fair. Who would you rather put your money on? And let's say the odds were even. I'm going to say the odds are actually even payouts, like you're just getting the same between the two, Phil or Jordan Spieth to win the Masters. Sorry.
Wow. You know what? I think even though Spieth's game is a little off right now, I would still take him over wow. Phil. Yeah,
his odds are better. We're going to get to some Masters odds in a bit. It's got to be Phil for me. His driving isn't great, but if he can just go in 1 week and know, hey, on 12 of the 14 holes, I got to hit driver. I know I just need to hit it right to left. That takes so much pressure off of him, and why he's played so well at the Masters. That is he going to win? Absolutely not. I will bet anybody whatever they want that Phil isn't going to win the Masters this year. We have said, though, and I've been the one to say, like, could he be in the mix at a major at some point again in his career? If there's anybody sure. in their 50s right now, it's Phil that I trust to do that just based on the length of his swing and his short game. But if you're giving me those two, I got to go with Phil. I know it doesn't make sense. He's double the age of Jordan, but... I don't know.
I mean, I'd say his skill set is there. You have to look at it that way. The other side that I look at is the fact that, you know, at 50 years old, for somebody who has rheumatoid arthritis, even though he looks fairly energetic and he's obviously doing a lot of fitness things, he's, you know, drinking whatever his wellness coffee and whatever stuff he's kind of selling. It's Augusta National. That's a tough place to walk. All week up and down those hills. And if you get any type of weather, we're talking about November here too, while the weather is somewhat similar to what it is in April, there's a possibility something else could happen where it gets a lot colder. You know, there's just that factor I have to think of as well. So at half his age, I think Spieth may be in a little bit better physically shape, to get it up and down those hills and play Augusta National. I think that's part of what has to happen at Augusta as well. It's important to be physically prepared to play that golf course all week long.
That is fair. Talking to a caddy that is caddying this week at the Zozo, just from a few photos going doing their first loop, they said that the Zozo Championship, wherever they were, wherever they are this week, do you know the golf
Sherwood.
Club? At Sherwood, he said yeah. it has knocked Augusta out of his top five for hardest walks for a caddy. Mm-hmm. It looks yeah. brutal, which is riveting for three people listening to this that have carried a tour bag before. But speaking of where they were this week, they were at the CJ Cup. Jason Kokrak finally gets his first win. If I had told you this guy has played in 233 PGA Tour events, you might be shocked. This guy's been out on tour since 2012 and as full-time status, made $14 million. He has a cup, 3 seconds, 3 thirds, just grinding it out, just, you know, just a guy out there. And then over the last couple of years has just kind of gotten close and finally picks up his win. I'm not going to ask you about that. I want you to go to his PGA Tour profile really quickly and just look at his photo. And I want you to tell me, if he was not playing golf — also, there's a 0% chance this guy's 225 pounds. If he was not playing golf, what would Jason Kokrak be doing?
Oh, he'd clearly be a bouncer someplace. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, he's sponsored by BetMGM. He would be standing at the door at the Bellagio trying to keep you out from going into the Hyde nightclub, I think. He's a big dude. And yeah, you wouldn't pick him out as a golfer, that's for sure.
He's 6'4". And this guy's
and not 225.
Do you think he's closer to 325 or 225?
Ooh. No, you know what? I think if you look at him from a, you know, when people see him on TV and stuff like that, he looks bigger than he is. He's a big dude, don't get me wrong. But I would say, you know, when you see him in person, he's probably going 255, 260 when you see him in person.
That's fair. Okay, so you're going on the 225 side. Fair enough. But, you know, I didn't watch a lot of it. I kind of sprinkled in and out. It's a tournament that it was
didn't
just thrown there, but I love Shadow Creek. I think it's a really cool place. I love the aerial views where it just zooms out and you're like, this is literally just in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the desert. And the other cool part, and I wasn't also aware that Chambers Bay did the same thing, that was a flat piece of property that they've added dirt to make these mounds and these hills and everything. Yeah. It is a cool place. It's green. I thought it was different. And, you know, you and I are not lovers of green golf courses, but, you know, when it's in the desert, it's something different.
Yeah, you know, they had to spend mega millions to build this from the ground up. I mean, if you look at it, obviously you see the trees and everything. And I was laughing because, you know, on the golf TV broadcast, they were saying, oh, you know, it almost looks artificial. Well, yeah, it is artificial. So
everything's artificial. You know, about golf.
You know, it is in this case with the, you know, with the waterfall and stuff like this. And you know what? MGM built this golf course as sort of a high end retreat. For a lot of years, you couldn't even access this place. You can now as far as part of the MGM properties. But that, I think, is a little bit of an advantage for Kokrak. He is sponsored by them. So he said he'd played 20 plus rounds there previously, which a lot of players hadn't. And, you know, in talking to John Graham, who's a, you know, putting coach to players like Cameron Champ, Danny Willett, you know, Joel Damon, I was talking to him a little bit while he was there. And he said, you know, the golf course it's amazing, the conditions that it's in. If you hit the ball on the right spot on the greens, you're okay. But if you don't, they were a nightmare. So obviously Kokrak had a great week where he was striking the golf ball, and the players loved it there. I mean, for a lot of reasons, you know, it ended their two week run in Vegas. I'm sure a lot of the players enjoyed being in Vegas, that's for sure. But unfortunately, it won't be back there. You know, it will go back to its usual location in Korea probably next year. But in the meantime, it was fun to see Shadow Creek for 4 days.
Yeah, and the last time we would have saw it was that first match with Tiger and Phil. It's justice on TV, and that's the key. The Zozo Championship is starting this week. Tiger making his return. This will be the last time you will see him before Augusta National. What should we expect? I don't think much.
Yeah, I'm not expecting much, even though he's had a lot of success on this golf course before. I mean, it hosted the Hero World Challenge, which, you know, we'll get into in a bit as far as, you know, its status for this year. But
RIP.
RIP, it is not happening this year in the Bahamas.
We got to it. Moving on.
There you go. No big surprise. It's over. That's the news. It did host the tournament from 2000 to 2013. Limited field event. And, you know, he did manage to win five times there, finished second five times in, you know, that's 10 of his 12 starts at the tournament when he was there. So he's played it well, but certainly, you know, there's got to be some rust in his game. I will say, though, one of the reasons why this golf course really suited him is that it really rewards a player who can really shape the ball and work it around. And he's a guy who really needs that rather than something that's, you know, Torrey Pines, he may have won there. You know, it's just bowling alleys straight up and down. But this probably lends into the artistic side of him, where he's got to shape shots and move it around and be in the right spots. So, you know, he might play well. I'm not expecting him to win here, but it would be neat. I mean, this is where he's chasing his 83rd. He won the Zozo, obviously, last year in Japan. would it be neat for him to win in Southern California and get his 83rd and be the all-time winning player on the PGA Tour? Sure, but I don't
think it would be as neat as him winning it at the Masters, though, back-to-back.
Oh, of course not. That would be the best.
34-1 for Tiger if you're in the betting world for him to win this week. John Rahm's got the best at 11-1. So,
isn't everybody in the betting world now that we saw the odds live on TV during
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah. Just throwing the odds out. You got to do that. This is the world we live in. Own it.
And that's what the PGA Tour is at now. Obviously, they've got betting partners now, so they are going to mention that. You know, hopefully they mention it more than FedEx points. If that's the case, they're certainly going to retain the
audience.
Well,
they're not mentioning the Wyndham points anymore, as Wyndham gutted that. So,
yeah.
Don't know what's going to happen there. But I think, though, because of this betting stuff and them mentioning it, they got to move faster on getting every player's shot at every single time being able to be filmed. Because that's where they're going to make money, is that you're going to be able to throw it on the Brian Gays of the world. Is Brian Gay going to make this 25-foot putt 40, you know, 8-1? Yes. You know, those are the types of things that... You know the MGMs and those places are pushing PGA Tour to be like, hey, you know what? We'll pay for the cameras out there if you're going to do it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's where it's going to go. I mean, you're going to get those guys sitting in Vegas at the sports book where you've got 100 TVs and, you know, you're able to, you know, dial one in for yourself and go, okay, I want to follow that player and I want to make that bet. And like you say, Brian Gay's a great example, a guy who's a great putter. You know, he's somebody you might want to sprinkle a dollar or two on when he's making those putts, because you can make some money away from just the usual bets of who is going to win. It's all those prop bets that become fun, engage the people, just like that happens in, you know, football, obviously, you know, be it college or pro football. It's a lot of those other things that keep the audience engaged, fantasy football, things like that. You know, obviously, we've seen it a little bit in fantasy golf. Now that we're able to do some betting on live golf, it's going to be that much more complex, but it's also going to be that much more attractive, certainly for the younger audience.
100%. Some good groups, though. We got Tiger with Matt Wolf and Xander, Rory with Phil and Webb. It'll be nice to see how Phil's game translates over. Did he learn something this week? The shots I was watching, he was throwing the ball everywhere with the driver, so who knows? I don't know enough about Sherwood, really. You know, clearly at the shape.
A lot tighter than the Country Club of Virginia, that's for sure.
Hey, don't talk about my people in Virginia like that. They're lovely people. Justin Thomas with Colin Morikawa and Patrick Reed, poor Colin. And Decky with John Rahm and Justin Rose. So look forward to that. I'll be throwing that on the background this week. I won't be throwing the Hero World Challenge. That's been canceled, as we've talked about. It's too bad that will take place. But hey, what can you do? It makes sense. It's usually in the Bahamas. Tiger's probably got to be safe. We talk about it. Tiger gets COVID. That's just awful for the PGA Tour. So let's move on from that. And the Masters isn't far away, Scott. It's crazy to think.
Do not forget the LPGA in there. They're going to be playing the Drive-On Championship at Reynolds Plantation. They're in Georgia this week. That's one of those events that's made to fill the schedule. 108-player field there. Fantastic facility. If you ever get a chance to get to Reynolds, it's quite amazing. A couple of Canadians in there as well. Brooke Henderson's not playing. Alina Sharp is playing. Jacqueline Lee is. Got some of the top players from the tour there. Hopefully, they're going to get some coverage on the Golf Channel. Don't know what the timing is on that, but hopefully it's at a decent timing. So more fans can get a chance to see some of that.
Absolutely. Well, as I said, we're less than a month away from the Masters. It's crazy. We're gonna have Augusta. Two Masters in a row for major championships. November 12th is when we tee off. We've started looking ahead at some odds here, and what we're gonna do is we're just like, hey, you want to make some money? Here's some guys with big odds, you know, good odds. Throw some money on it now before the rest of the people get out there. That being said, we don't encourage gambling. Yes, we do. But do what you got to do. So, Scotty, I'm going to get you to go first with your first player that you're liking the odds on them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously there's the, you know, the top players everybody looks at, but, you know, it's hard to make a dollar on Bryson DeChambeau when, you know, he's going 17-2. So, you know what, I looked a little deeper down to the guys that were 100-1, trying to have a look at the players that maybe hadn't played in the tournament before, might have some success, or other players that people wouldn't be paying attention to. So one of those ones that I know a lot of people might not be paying attention to because he missed the cut last year in his first start at the Masters, Matt Wallace. You know what? He's coming off a second place finish in Scotland, solid player. Although he did miss that cut at the Masters last year, he tied for third at the PGA and in 19, and then also had a 12th place finish at Pebble Beach. So he's getting a little bit more comfortable, and he's also played well at the Memorial, which is very much a Masters-like setup. Jack Nicklaus obviously sets it up that way. So I think he's sort of a sneaky guy that I think could get in there under the radar and earn you something.
I like that. Matt Wallace is a guy he's going to break through here one of these days. And then he's just going to come over here for a couple years and play just 2-3 full years on the PGA Tour and just take a bunch of people's money. He's a guy that plays with heart. I love Matt Wallace. He's also a guy that that you're downtown Galway and you run into this guy or downtown wherever he's from. He's not Irish.
You're going for a bevy. He's English.
Yeah, and he's sitting there with you and you're having a good time. So I'm all for Matt Wallace. I'm going to go with another guy that you talked about, Matt, being his second year there. This is his second year playing the Masters as well. Joaquin Niemann. He's paying 100-1 right now. Yes, he did miss the cut in 2018. So he didn't play last year in 2019. But this guy had a great year. Obviously won the Greenbrier. If I was betting on him, I'm probably looking at top 10 odds, not actually to win. I feel like you need a couple loops around Augusta to really actually win there. He just finished sixth last week. I think this guy's a player. His swing, I think, throws people off that dip through contact.
Big side bend there. It looks like he's going to snap in half, but he gets it done.
And he might be 145 pounds soaking wet. He's actually closer to 125 than Jason's 225. I like that. I don't know the top 10 odds on Joaquin, but if it's my money, I'm throwing it top 10, not him to win. But hey, if you got more stones than I do, 100-1 for him winning.
Yeah, two other ones at 101 who, you know what, I'll take them for the fact that I like their form, I like their skills, I like what they bring to the game. They are both going to play in their first Masters, so that sort of scares me a little bit because right from the perspective that you're talking about, you need a few laps around there to get a feel for it. It's not a place that rookies generally win or do well, but Kokrak, who obviously is coming off some momentum, he's figured out his putting, which has always been the key for him. This is why he hasn't broke through as a winner. He's made some adjustments there, got to a longer putter, gives a lot of credit to his caddy who really fixed him up with his putting, who's was a PGA professional. I think Kokrak could do some damage there. Again, you're playing a big ballpark. He's 180 mile an hour ball speed. See, I got that right this time.
Nailed it.
He gets it done that way. And you know what? In the same vein, Cameron Champ, who's going to be exciting to watch there. And the reason why I like Cameron Champ even a little bit better here, he's got some different shots, probably some different ones than Jason has. And I like his putting form a little bit better. He's definitely got that skills to do it there. He's excited to play in the Masters. He wants to get it done. I think there's some neat ties in there for him, talking about from the race side of it. That's been a big discussion point of him getting there and being important, especially, to his grandfather. It was very important for him to get there. And I think he's a guy that will provide him a little bit of extra energy. And so I think those two, Jason Kokrak and Cameron Champ, both at 101 are good value.
And I know we've talked about on this podcast before. I love Augusta National. Like anybody else out here, I know this following statement after this probably means if they somehow listen to this, I'm never playing it. I love the golf course. If you're saying one golf course that you're playing, doesn't matter the price, I'm going to Augusta because of exclusivity, but it's an amazing thing. That being said, if you do some research on the racial issues that this golf course has had over the years, that just start there. And deep down, and I hope you learned something. And I hope, it's been great that Tiger's won over the years. And I know Tiger has kind of kept away from those issues. And I wish he hasn't. I have a feeling people like Cameron Champ wouldn't do that. Harold Varner III wouldn't do that. They would speak up. Those are people I want to see at the Masters. And hopefully we can make hold Augusta accountable for its past that they've kind of brushed under the table. That being said, to turn it back onto a less serious note, and we're talking about just throwing random golf bets onto random players. One guy that's played well for a long time there, and he's played well in a lot of majors and never got one, though, Matt Kuchar. He is on the wrong end of his career at this point, getting into his later 40s, I believe. Maybe. Is he even 45? I don't
know. Not quite yet.
Sure. He's still on it. He's heading. He's seeing the back nine. He's teeing off on the eighth.
Oh, you're
hole.
Making me feel good there.
Oh, dude, you're in the nine. You're in the clubhouse. he's paying 80-1. Why I think you should bet on Matt Kuchar, and I'm saying like this is a good bet for a win. Even he's always in the mix. In the last 8 years, 50% of those times he's had a top 10. Right, top 10s. That's a couple shots from mm-hmm. him picking up a win here. He hits fairways when he wants to. He's not long. He has an ability to. He plays that same shot shape, which is kind of counter to most Augusta golf holes. However, it's clearly worked. So I like Matt Kuchar. His putting's been good in recent years. Why isn't it his turn, you know, at whatever age he is, 43, 44?
42.
42. There you go. And then the other guy, I haven't talked about this guy in a while on this podcast for a long time.
At least one or two shows.
Yeah. Well, at one point in time, we were talking about changing this to being the Paul Casey podcast brought to you by Flagstick.com T-Talk Invitational Pro-Am. He's at 66-1 for Paul Casey. And you're probably like, yeah, you're a homer for him. He has five top tens at Augusta, T2 at the PGA this year, T17 at the US Open.
He's only 43.
But the reason why you throw money on Paul Casey at 66-1, Scott, why do you think it is?
Oh, it's all about his Popeye forearms.
It's his forearms. You gotta put money on those forearms. If it's not just a cheer for him, and those forearms, you gotta go for it. Paul Casey, a beauty, another good Englishman. I'm gonna do one more, and maybe you got one. I'm gonna call it the burn your money bet. It basically means you grab your cash, you light it on fire, because there's a better chance of that cash lighting on fire and making you money than there is betting on this person and actually winning money. My bet on the burn your money bet the anti bet on that bet is Jordan Spieth at 41. That is horrible, horrible, awful.
You really think it's that bad?
Terrible odds. Odds. Do I think he'd make the cut? Sure. But he's not winning at 40-1. There's other players in that same vein that, you know, have a better chance at winning that just because they haven't won there. You know, they're kind of getting screwed out of the money. Like,
yeah.
Sorry, I'm just trying to pull that up right now because I'm so frustrated there. You said Jordan Spieth 40-1. It's actually gone up, but Adam Scott, you can get up at 41. Jason Day at 51-1. Give me Jason Day.
You know, the other one who's good, which I should have really mentioned, but, you know, you talk about players that could come in there and be sneaky, who are a major champion already, but Shane Lowry, who a lot of the other players on the European Tour say, this guy's hands, he's just got velvet paws. And you know what? You need that around Augusta National. So there's a guy who could, return something for you. I think a player that, if you want to burn your cash, I don't know. You look among the top guys there that are, it's hard to say. I think you have to go pretty far down. I mean, I would say Danny Willett, even though he's won there, I don't know if he's going to ever repeat there. 125-1, I think that's pretty favorable for him, and I wouldn't be really interested in that one at all, even though he's got a title.
If you had to throw your money on one person that has won at Augusta this week, prior to this year, obviously, yeah. Who are you putting that money on?
Ooh, to win. Let me look.
Obviously, we had Tiger in the field. That's at 26-1. Bubba Watson at 36. Adam Scott, 41. Sergio at 51.
You know what? I would actually take Sergio. I mean, he's in great form right now. He's got a win. Recently, ball striking is a good place in his life. I wouldn't be shocked for him to get a second major and to get a second Masters. So, you know, 50-1, yeah, why not? I'd go for that.
That's not a bad, like, I feel like at that
point. Hard to argue that one, I think.
No, I agree. You're the gap from there, there's a pretty decent gap to fill,
yeah,
you know, at 71-1. From there, I'm scrolling here.
You're going Scotty. A long way down to find a major champion or find a Masters champion.
Yeah, Bernhard Langer is the next one at 501-1.
Yeah,
The next best odds. Can you imagine betting Bernhard Langer to win this over somebody like Jimmy Walker? That's just crazy thing. Oh, sorry. Charles Schwartzel was the next one at 226, but I'm still not throwing that. I do like that. I think Sergio's a good call. I think I'm going to go Bubba
I think he's what, 35-1 or something like that. So I think that would definitely be I don't know if he's in the greatest form or whatever, but you know, he obviously can get it done around there more than just once. He's not, and I'm not saying Danny Willett was a fluke, but you know, he did it one time, whereas Bubba's done it twice. So obviously I think there's a greater opportunity for a guy like that to you know, to win it a third time.
Yeah, I like where Bubba's at. Maybe his game's not looking that way, but he just seems to be in a better place. I think he's content that if he never won again, he'd be okay with it. He just seems more positive when you see him around and you see him on TV.
Did you catch that a little bit when he did the charity event at you know, he acted pretty much as the host for the Vegas event, the CJ Cup, when they had their charity challenge. He basically had come. He was the guy who was actually behind all those charity challenges. He came to the commissioner and thought that was a great idea to raise money. And you know, he was actually interviewing the other players, and I thought that was great.
It shouldn't surprise you. I'm sure you've met Bubba and stood beside him before. Guy is an extrovert through and through. So when you're like, hey, we need a guy on TV, get Bubba. He'll make it entertaining. So I think the guys have learned to love Bubba. I think he was misunderstood for a lot of years out on tour. So I think he's in a good place. Similar to Sergio. I think, you know, the longer you're out there on tour, the more people start to accept you for you just being you versus, you know, this guy's new and they're just acting this way and it's different than how I would act. So I'm no longer going to like this person. So I like Bubba at 36-1 and I'm just looking forward to it. It's a month away. We're going to talk all about it. Who knows what guests we're going to get on over the next couple of weeks, but expect a trend of a lot of Masters talk. That being said, we got a new guest on this podcast before, a local guest, can be found all around the world with Acra Golf. Who do we have this week, Scotty, and why is it important you listen to this interview?
Yeah, Gavin Robertson, who I've known for quite some time. Gavin's the director of aftermarket sales for True Temper, Project X, and Acra at True Sports. Got a lot of history in the game. The cool part about Gavin is they've got a neat story of how their company came to be and how he went from being a golf pro to being, you know, a key guy in the golf shaft business around the world. But, you know, he's got great stories, great insight on what happens out on tour, about how shafts are developed, what players need to think about a little bit when they're, you know, talking about shafts as far as their own self versus what the tour players are playing. And, you know, he's generally just a smart guy, always fun to be around. And you know what? The other side of it, he's a longtime listener of the podcast. And, you know, it's been way too long before we've got him on this show.
Yeah, you're going to enjoy this interview. At the end of the interview, after we wrapped up, he told me that there's no one he disagrees more in the golf industry than me. So that was the biggest
compliment. That's a badge of honor.
I've ever had. And because of that, we actually brought Birdie versus Bogey back onto the podcast. So stick around for the end of the interview to listen to that. But I promise you, you will enjoy this interview from Acra Golf and True Temper, Gavin Robertson.
All right, we want to welcome to the Tee Talk podcast, Gavin Robertson, good friend, known him quite some time. He's now the director of aftermarket sales for True Temper, Project X, and Acra at True Sports. There's probably a few other things in there, but whatever the case, welcome, Gavin. We know you listen to the podcast a fair bit, so it's great to have you on the show.
Oh, it's truly a pleasure to be on the show. Like you said, I have been listening to this podcast. I've heard all your guys' stories, and it's exciting to be on here.
Well, I don't know if it's going to be that exciting as a guest, but we'll find out. That'll be up to you. But, you know, first things first, I mean, obviously, I know your story, having known you for quite some time, but you're a guy who, you know, grew up as a golfer. And why don't you explain to our listeners a little bit about your background and, you know, as a golf professional as well, and how you got into the business that you're in now?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's just the golf side of it started really trying to follow the dream of being a PGA Tour pro. But at the same time, I kind of went through the Canadian PGA assistance program as I was playing mini tours and stuff like that, and realized very quickly I wasn't going to be on the PGA Tour. And so went the route of club professional, of which I ended up by being a head professional for about 9 years, I guess it was. And around towards the end of my that part of my career, I kind of realized that I was a golf geek all the way along, loved equipment, loved stuff like that, like to, you know, use the crazy stuff that no one had heard of. I know somebody else like that, right, Scott?
Two of us here.
But anyway, and I'd spent a lot of time on the PGA Tour. A good friend of mine, we know him, Sean Mullen, was working for UST as a tour rep. And so I used to go hang out with him a lot, and I got to know a lot of the guys out there. And so I kind of came up with this great thing that, why don't I get involved in the golf shaft business? And talked to a few of the shaft tour reps and went and interviewed with Royal Precision at the time and UST and Fujikura and stuff like that. And right at the same time, my business partner, we were involved in a golf course, worked for Wilson Sports and Dave Macarucha. And, you know, as I was talking to him, there were a lot of changes going on at Wilson, and he was going to get sort of that golden parachute type thing. And he kind of came to me and sort of said, you know, rather than you go work for a shaft company and make X dollars, why don't we start a distributorship? And so, you know, we went up by going down and talking to Royal Precision, came up with a cool idea of, rather than being a distributor, we'd actually represent their company in Canada. And there was some small OEMs in Canada back in the day. And we thought that would be kind of a cool way to get in there, rather than just be your Golfsmith, Golfworks, try to carry everything thing. And they liked the idea of that. At the same time, we pitched UST and Fujikura, and UST really liked the idea and kind of gave us some freedom. So we ended up by sort of starting a business in Canada where we were distributing, but kind of working directly with those two companies. Well, after a few years, we realized Canada was really small and the golf industry was really small. And we kind of wanted to do something bigger. And quite honestly, we kind of approached UST with this sort of concept for a direct to club fitter brand. And this is 17, 18 years ago when club fitters were kind of that, I use that witches and warlock type thing where, you know, most of them were working out of basements. People didn't really know what they were doing. Most of them didn't deal with big OEM stuff. They had these sort of, you know, components, clubs but we sort of saw, I sort of saw this growth in that part of the business. And for 17 years, I've been saying, if, you know, at the time, 2% of the golf industry was probably done by club fitters. And I always said, if it ever got to 5%, we'd all be so busy, we wouldn't do it ourselves. And now you look at the industry, and I think they're saying it's something like 25 to 30% of the industry now, it may be even more than that, is club fitting. So anyway, long story short, we started Acra and started out of our basements. And basically, I was working on my basement. Dave was working at his basement. I was kind of handling the marketing side of things and got into designing golf shafts with the guys at UST at the time. And we kind of grew from there into the point, after about 4 years, we wanted to go out on our own. We sort of separated from everybody. Royal Precision, I think, sort of was bought by True Temper at the time, which is, it all comes back full circle. So we grew Acra. We developed relationships with manufacturing overseas, and we create our own little world. And it grew and grew, and as the club fitting industry grew, and we were very fortunate. We got in at the right time. There were a lot of lucky things that happened along the way. And then we moved into the facility we're in now, and we developed a relationship with another steel shaft company for a number of years, which helped us grow a little bit. And then True Temper came along about 5 years ago and said, you know, we'd really like to get involved with you guys. You have a great relationship with the club fitting world, and that's a growing part of the business. And so we sort of had a lot of talks with them, and it seemed like a good fit. And so for 5 years, we sort of distributed all True Temper shafts to the aftermarket worldwide. And then about last June, a year and a few months ago, True Temper came to us and said, we'd like to acquire you. And so we went through some negotiations on that, And now I'm working for True Temper. And when you, sorry, I'm talking a lot here. It's sort of a long story. And the funny thing after that is I became sort of director of aftermarket sales, and our facility actually has grown, and we can talk about that later. But the cool thing about that is a few months later, the guys at True Temper sort of came to me and said, "What about Aerotech?" And Aerotech had been a huge competitor of ours for a long time. And Chris Hillary, who owned Aerotech, was a great friend of mine. We both started our companies at the same time. Used to go out every year and play golf and whatever. And I got to kind of go and approach him and say, you know, what do you think about selling? And I was involved in that. And we ended up by moving that whole facility from Washington State to Kingston, Ontario. And now Acura and Aerotech are all under one roof, and pretty much most of True Temper's under this roof too. And it's a pretty big roof now. So there, that's the more than 30-second version, but it's that's my story.
What's the long version of that one?
we just lengthened your show to an hour and a half.
There you go. We'll make sure we write long. If that was just question one, maybe this isn't the best question for you. I was going to ask what your elevator pitch was back in the day when you were talking about Acura, which, you know, some people might know, some people might not know. You know, like you can find them anywhere from, you know, a lot of local players in this area because of its, you know, its ties to Kingston. But when you're out on tour, many guys are out there using them. So what was your pitch back then when you were just marketing out of your basement, and how has that changed nowadays?
Well, I mean, at the time, we wanted to, our philosophy has always been to develop a tour quality shaft that was available only through professional club fitters, which is really unique because the Fujikuras and Mitsubishis and stuff like that were available everywhere. So you'd find a new TaylorMade driver, a Callaway driver with a Mitsubishi in it. Plus you'd see their premium shafts in aftermarket and club fitters and being sold online and blah, blah, blah. And we wanted to do something that was a little bit unique. And so that was our sort of our pitch was we went out and got some tour players right off the bat, which was great. And so we had some credibility, and then we'd go to these guys and say, look, this is exclusive to you. You know, we'll give you something that's sort of your own. And we got lucky and it worked, but, we had good, you know, we had good products, good stories. All of our shafts are designed for club fitters. So we offer like a real wide range and some funky designs. And the idea behind that is we don't have to worry about making a design that can be mass produced for OEMs, for Titleist, Callaway, TaylorMade. We can do something that's really kind of off the wall. So our shafts tend to be very unique. And so when you're fitting somebody, and I know you've been fitting a lot of people for many years, when you get something that has sort of a wow factor on a launch monitor, it does something different because there's so many kind of, you know, vanilla shafts out there that are kind of that middle of the road, mid, that we like to do things that are a little crazy. And that helped.
So for you guys, I mean, obviously getting that traction on tour was super important to add the validity and things like that. But how hard was it to get those tour players in the first place to make those changes? Because as we know, those players are pretty fickle about what goes in their bag, and you only have a couple of swings to convince them to put it in their bag, right?
Yeah, you know what? There's all different ways. The tour is very political, and we can go on a whole, you know, story about that. Where, I mean, obviously, you have the major manufacturers that pay players to use it, and I know last week you guys were even talking a little bit about that, how that's changing. Mm-hmm. But you know, so you have to kind of go through. Let's say it's a TaylorMade player, even if you have a relationship and you develop a relationship. But a lot of the stuff on tour is who you took out for dinner the night before. So hopefully you went out for dinner with a tour player and you developed a relationship. Hopefully a player used your shaft before and he actually asks for it next time.
Let's go back to that for a second. Isn't it funny that millionaires still love anything that's free? Like,
oh
that
my God.
You can get a guy using your equipment for a glass of wine. Like, you know, you could buy this yourself, right?
You know, it's relationships. It's like any business relationship. So you hope you've taken the guys from TaylorMade out for dinner and they like you. And when they've got John Rahm looking at a new driver, that they're gonna come to you and say, hey, John's looking for something that that flies a couple degrees lower, it spins a little less. What do you got? And the way, and like what Scott said a second ago, you do literally have one shot. It's not like mm-hmm. a fitting at Modern Golf or TXG, as you know, in Toronto or
where they're paying you versus you're trying to get.
But it's
to
use yeah, but you get a lot different. More options, and you get a lot more time to hit. On tour, you get two or three swings to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And you're hoping that, like I said, the TaylorMade Callaway Titleist guy, PXG guy, whatever it is, gives you that shot, or the player asks for your product. And then you hope you know enough about that player's swing that you can figure out the right shaft, the right tipping to make it work. And like I said, you got 2-3 swings to make a difference. Otherwise, you know, a player's going to adapt and it's not going to make a difference.
I mean, people probably are not sure, you know, that process of dealing with the player and how it works. And obviously that's what you're talking about here. But sometimes the product can be great, but even the color can be wrong for that player. I can remember you telling me, I won't say who the player is.
I need the name.
I can remember you early on fitting a player, going through a lot of work. And this is before the tips were available. So you had to really burn through shafts. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it was the wrong color because it was a rival college.
Exactly.
And wouldn't do it.
I mean, that happens more often than you think. We had a coppery kind of orangey shaft that was a competitive shaft to another player from Texas, and would not use it. And his numbers were awesome. I think it was a Titleist guy at the time. And the Titleist guys were saying how great the shaft was, and he would not use it. That's one of the reasons we started a custom program with Acro. We do all sorts of funky colors and stuff on our shafts for people, for anybody. But it was great for tour players because we could make, as you know, Ryan Palmer's kind of a good buddy of mine. We make up stuff for Texas A&M colors for him and stuff. And guys love that. But it's amazing how easily a tour player can be swayed by a color.
we're big Ryan Palmer fans on here. I'm pretty sure he's still getting away for murder after killing Carlos Ortiz after that tournament earlier this year, that Webb Simpson one. Haven't seen Carlos since. I want to know more stories, though, around, you know, interesting situations with tour players. I think these are the insight that people love to hear. Do you have any other stories of, you know, something either going completely wrong or, you know, completely shocking the other way where they, you know, weren't going to give you the time and one swing almost changed their life?
Yeah, you know, there's so many stories. I was fortunate to work with Luke Dahl when he was number one. He was using a couple of our shafts, driver, three wood, for his whole, you know, span of being number one in the world. And, you know, in that case, it was kind of a three wood that worked, and it was like he was just going to change drivers. And it's like, do you have a shaft that's like the three wood that will work in my driver? And it's like, well, we have one that's 10 grams lighter. Try it. And he loved it. That was like an easy one. But then I'll tell you, actually, Gary Woodland's a good one. So Gary Woodland, used our shafts for a number of years, uses our shaft for a number of years and won the US Open with it. But 6 years ago, what's that?
Was that good, winning the U.S. Open with your shaft?
Acro shaft, it's a great one.
All right. I think there was some champagne pop that day. Yeah.
Continue.
But I mean, the funny thing with that is the year before he used it, we were fitting him at the PGA Championship, and he was just striping his driver at the range, the shaft at the range. It was a heavy, very stiff shaft, and he got on the first tee, and I was so excited that Gary Woodland might actually use our shaft, and he's such a great guy, and he gets in the first tee for the practice round and just wails one about 100 yards right. And I was like, oh my God. And then the second hole, he does the same thing. And the third hole, he does the same thing. It's like all of a sudden it's his bag. And you get like that kind of thing happens a lot. And it's so frustrating. And you know, you just don't get much of a shot. You get those kind of like 2-3 drives and it doesn't work. It goes back in the bag. But then, you know, a year later, I'm working with the Canadian Open. It was kind of a fluky thing. And, we had great success, and I literally got the driver in play on the Wednesday before the thing, the tournament started. He ends up coming in third place, calls, his caddy is a good buddy of mine, Mike Weir's old caddy, Butchie. And Butchie gives me a call and says, hey, you coming to Firestone the next week? And I go, yeah, I'm coming down there. And he goes, we need a three wood too. And fit him to a three wood there. Loved it. The very next week was the PGA Championship. I get a call saying, you coming to the PGA Championship? And I go, yeah. And he goes, we need a five wood. And, you know, and so all of a sudden we got a driver, three wood, five wood in 3 weeks in play. And, you know, he's probably the higher maintenance guys on tour. He's always trying to lower his spin with his driver and raise spin with his three wood. And every week you're playing around, picking heads and stuff for him, but he's the nicest guy in the world and you want to do it for him.
Many stories of the opposite.
and there's a ton of stories that guys that come in the tour van, you run. You know, there's all sorts of cool stories about it, but you know, there's you know, you get home runs and you get strikeouts.
Well, it's a good transition just over to the year that we're having right now and how that's kind of potentially changed for you. And, you know, for some in the industry, you could say this is a strikeout of a year. For others, you can say it's a home run. How's it sitting for you in the club shaft business?
So the golf industry, as we as you've probably heard and we all kind of know, has actually benefited from this whole thing, but it didn't start that way. And you know, the way the golf industry kind of works is the northeast of the U.S., California, which is really a summer place for buying, and Europe and Asia drive the industry. So pretty much all companies ramp up their sales for the spring in the northern hemisphere. And, you know, we went to the PGA show this past January with high hopes. January started off really good. We were ramping up our production for spring, new lines and things like that. We were introducing a new steel shaft this year, an Acro steel shaft. We were all excited. And, you know, we're talking to our manufacturers saying, let's get going. And then all of a sudden, end of January kind of hits and COVID hits in China. And all of Asia basically started shutting down, including our facilities in Japan. And it's like, oh, no. And we're getting orders and orders and orders. And we can't get product because nothing's being produced. And then all of a sudden, things start flipping over to here in March. And it's kind of funny. All of a sudden, our factories are opening up in Asia. And we're saying, no, we don't want stuff now because everything's shutting down here. And so it goes kind of crazy. And all of a sudden, we're down to working from home like everybody else was March 8th. Right? It was like, is this year going to be a bust? And as Scott probably knows, we did Zoom calls with our fitters every week. And we were calling all from all over the world. And we're all sharing horror stories. And we were able to still ship out of our facility. We had a couple of warehouse guys in practicing social distancing, but we were really slow. And all of a sudden, June 1st hit, and it was like all hell broke loose. We went from zero to 110. It was like the world opened up. And we got caught, like most of the golf industry, which you've probably heard, with back orders and back orders and back orders, because there's a, you know, 1, 2, 3 month lead time that got spread even more and more and more. And we had only so much product June 1st when we were getting, you know, June was a record month for us of all time. Then July beat that. Then August beat that. Then believe it or not, September was our biggest month we've ever had. It's where this come from. And so we've been chasing product, just like the bike industry and the boat industry, anything that's outside, went nuts. And we were caught in that. But having said that, it made for a good year.
So as a marketing guy, and that's potentially being, you know, a little bit your background, your start, how do you continue that engagement going into 2021?
Great question. So, I mean, we look at 2021, especially from a Canadian perspective, and I think even in the US, I don't think a lot of people are scheduling that European vacation next year. So we're kind of looking at...
Why? What happened?
So we're thinking, I'll tell you just quick side story. I tried to get a tee off time in Toronto last Wednesday, and good luck at any private club, anywhere you want to go in Toronto. Here we are, middle of October, could not get a tee time in Canada.
You know what? I look back now and probably, Scott, we probably shouldn't have complained about that one we had. Eh?
No.
Yeah, you know, but we're elitists on the tee time podcast.
the whole idea now is, you know, we're the club fitting industry, the aftermarket in general, OEM business, meaning pro shop business and golf town business and PGA superstores business is all up across the board. Hopefully golf courses don't try and overtake advantage of this. I mean, I heard all sorts of stories, the northeast of the US and in Toronto as well, where some of the public courses were jacking up prices and stuff because they were so full. But the problem is we need all these occasional golfers who have become more core golfers to maintain. And I'm hoping we don't price ourselves out by what happened this year. Having said that, we look at 2021 as being another huge year. I mean, from a budgeting perspective, do you look at 2021 as 2019 plus 10%, or do you think it's actually going to extrapolate from 2020 and continue? And that's the tough thing to decide right now. But we're excited about 2021.
Well, I think the hard thing from your perspective, right, is for the people that have been in the industry and from a playing standpoint, you know, the avid golfers, they love to upgrade stuff. They love to invest in new products every year. You've got them hooked. It's how do we get the new people that are just joining the game to get hooked on that product, to buy that new product, to go get fit for that new product that we're coming out with and how it's going to improve their game. Are these the type of thoughts that are going through your head when Acro and True Temper are coming out with new stuff?
Sure. I mean, first of all, developing new product is always to make it fresh and make it exciting. I heard stories from guys like Club Champion in the US who have like 86 stores across the US, and and cool clubs and stuff that they had more beginner golfers going in to pay, get fit. And, you know, going to get fit at a high end place like that is not a cheap scenario. I mean, you're, and a beginner golfer going into something like that, they're not just going to a golf town or a PGA Superstores and buying something off the rack. These guys are actually investing in going to get fit. And that was kind of bizarre. It was caught everybody by surprise. I think all these newer guys who maybe played corporate golf, women who played corporate golf a couple times a year, all of a sudden found themselves playing 10, 15, 20 times a year, joining a golf course. And I think we've already seen it happening. I guess, like you said, the question is, how do we maintain that? And, you know, I think the world will kind of help maintain that if it stays the way it is with less travel, you know?
So for you guys, I mean, then do you lean on your fitters because you have this worldwide network of, you know, the best fitters in the game out there? You lean on them then to figure out where the products are going to go or what they need based on the customers they're seeing now? Because obviously you're trying to, you've got a length of a process to do. It's not like you can just flip over and bring a new shaft overnight. You have to think ahead what you're going to do because obviously there's production, everything else that's going to go with that. So how do you go about doing that process?
Well, there's two things. I mean, with Acura, which is specifically a club fitter brand, we are relying on club fitters to promote our product to get it in people's hands to try. It's got to work on a launch monitor. It's got to win the battle when guys are trying stuff. With True Temper and Project X and even Aerotech, a lot of that is through the marketing, and a lot of our marketing is being aimed more at the average golfer. We're developing more products than ever before in the lightweight sort of mid flex type category. You know, we designed things like the Elevate steel shaft, which is designed to be a tour shaft, but actually launch the ball up in the air with all the, you know, all these crazy new heads, which are awesome that have no loft. Even tour players are looking for a way to get the ball in the air sometimes, but we're trying to develop stuff that sort of helps those type of players as well. A lot of the new products we're designing, like I said, really sort of fit more into that occasional golfer type player. The other thing we're finding also is more and more X-Flex, double X-Flex type stuff being sold. And that's because there's so many of these 20, 30 something guys who are, you know, corporate golfers. They probably only played a few times a year before, but now, you know, they've got somebody, they want to go get fit. They want to have a nice, you know, Callaway or TaylorMade bag kind of thing with the cool new clubs. And these guys swing at 125 miles an hour, 130 miles an hour, the driver. They may not know where it's going, but that's, they're just, that it's the new generation as we see on tour. And so it's amazing how many, you know, X-Flex, double X-Flex, X7 iron shafts we sell. And it's just to get these guys to hit a little straighter. It's, you know, but that's sort of a new generation of golfers that's happening now. You know, these are sort of maybe some X Games guys who can't maybe travel as much and do the X Games type stuff that they used to do. They're actually getting back into golf, which maybe they played a few times and thought it was okay. Now it's a cool outdoor sport that I can do locally with my buddies and still drink.
Yeah, that last part might be important. We've beat
this horse.
It's in the ground at this point, but we're gonna dig it back up and beat it a little bit more. So, what are your thoughts on that though? On this state of the game of, you know, it's not just these random new guys that are just some. It's not like the new generation of people are way more jacked than previous generations. But you know, what is your thought on this mash it and go find it kind of golf that we're seeing on the PGA Tour, and clearly you're doing at an amateur level as well.
Yeah, you know. Look, I'm a bit of an old school guy. I go back to Balata balls and stuff like that. It's cool to see it. But you know what? I love the new golf game. And I mean, the fact is equipment has reached a point where younger guys and girls are growing up being able to swing as hard as they can. You know, when you were using a smaller steel head or a wooden head, if you're that old, whatever, you were learning to hit the ball straight. You had to. Nowadays with 460 high MOI heads and light graphite shafts and stuff, I mean, kids are growing up learning to swing hard. I mean, Scott will understand from a teaching perspective, we used to say, keep your feet on the ground. If your feet came off the ground, you were crazy. You're never going to hit the ball right. Nowadays, with you know, ground forces and stuff, the idea is to come off the ground, which we could never imagine before because the sweet spot was much smaller on a club face. So, you know, it's a new way. It's like any other sport. You can't compare to past eras. you look forward, and that's the new way golf is going. And I think it's great.
And from your perspective, it opens up a new line, right? Now we're talking double X's. We're talking heavier shafts, right? I'm selling more shafts now because I'm actually fitting in different markets, right? That I didn't even think was possible before.
100%. And it opens up new markets all the time, those kind of things. So yeah, I agree completely.
Well, speaking of new shafts, you talked about it off the top of these, first time of coming out with actual steel iron shafts with Acra. Why don't you tell us about the new I-Series steel iron shafts?
Yeah, so actually we did have, believe it or not, an Acra steel shaft many moons ago that Jeff Ogilvy actually won the U.S. Open with. It. Nobody really knows about because it wasn't branded Acra at the time. But that lasted about a year because Royal Precision kind of went wayward. But yeah, it was really cool. The relationship with True Temper gave us this opportunity. And I had been kind of looking at this design for a number of years that kind of melded the best of, I say, the two best shafts in the world, which is a Project X and a Dynamic Gold. And I looked at those two shafts and said, how can we put these two shafts together as one? So we create a shaft that basically has the top third of a Dynamic Gold, has the steps in it. You get that great feel, that smooth feel a Dynamic Gold has. And the bottom two thirds is a Project X type bottom. It's a straight taper. We use a really cool finish on it that's eco-friendly called Eco Satin. We do not use any nickel or chrome on the shaft, which are obviously not great for the environment. And so it's got a really cool brush finish on it. And we use like 10 gallons less water per golf shaft. Believe it or not, the process of making a golf shaft uses a lot of water, plus there's a lot of waste. And we get rid of all that. So it's kind of the first eco-friendly shaft in the world, but it also has a really cool performance value to it. Unfortunately, it got released in the middle of COVID hell. And and it's just sort of, it's just reaching its, pretty much every club fitter around the world that we deal with now has it. And it's been a huge success. We can't keep it in stock. That's been the biggest problem. But it's a really, really cool product. And we're so excited about it. It got us sort of into a new realm where it's a steel shaft that's only available through club fitters, branded Acra, and it has a cool playability standpoint to it.
And it feels really, really good. I've tested a few of them, right?
Yeah, that's the first comment we get all the time is it's very stable, but feels really, really smooth. And that's that combination. Dynamic Gold has that. And, like I said, you've got two iconic shafts there. Why not take advantage of the technology behind them and put it in one?
Absolutely. Everybody knows those two shafts. So why not mix the two together, make a great shaft? I can't wait to get that in my hands. I haven't been lucky enough to try it out. Sounds great. If you have listened to this podcast in the past, Gavin, we used to have a segment. We haven't done it in a few months. It was called Birdie or Bogey. Basically, it's a game where there are no winners. But there are definitely losers. And how it works is we're going to give five different topics and we're each going to go around the table. And we're going to say whether it's a birdie, you like it, or it's a bogey. There are no pars. You are allowed one eagle and you're allowed one double bogey in the game. And that's how we're going to wrap up this podcast. Are you ready for your first time ever playing birdie or bogey?
This is so funny. You don't know how many times I've listened to your show and said, man, I'd like to answer that. Now you're going to put me on the spot and I'm not going to be able to think of anything.
Well, here's the thing. If you just say whatever, nobody will remember when the next episode comes out. And that's why we've made it to, 89 episodes, something like that?
Yeah, 88, I think. Yeah,
that's awesome.
Exactly. We're at the Lindros episode.
We're Eric Lindros episode. I like that. All right. So our first birdie or bogey, we were talking about distance earlier. So earlier this week, Matthew Fitzpatrick said, it's not a skill to hit the ball a long way. Is that statement a birdie or a bogey for you, Gavin?
Definitely a bogey. If somebody is willing to go through the effort like Bryson did or Dustin does or Gary Woodland does, they deserve all the accolades they get from it.
Scotty.
Yeah, I'm right there with him. It's definitely a skill. It's something you can develop and you can get better at. You don't just get lucky at it. It's important, obviously, nowadays to pursue that. So certainly for me, that's a bogey.
I'm going to use this up early. This is a double bogey. if that was the case, Matthew Fitzpatrick would not hit the ball the length he hits it. Why wouldn't you want to hit it further and have less club in if you're able to hit it further and straighter? It's just a moronic take. I like Matt Fitzpatrick. I think he's a good dude. Nice lad. Good golf swing. But just an awful take. All right, next birdie or bogey. The Houston Open will allow 2,000 guests per day. Gavin, what do you think?
Oh, wow.
No pars.
No pars. Personally, I'm going to go bogey, although I have lots of friends in Dallas and Houston area who basically will tell you that you would never know that COVID is even existing there. And so I totally understand why they're doing it, because the majority of the people in that area, just they feel they should be able to go on with their regular life. But personally, I would say it's a bogey.
Yeah, I'm down with that as well. You know, I know it's a large space that they're going to have people around. You know, they can obviously keep them socially distanced. They're going to ask them to mask. Food's included in the pricing. They're going to do grab and go as far as the food. So they're trying to put in as many restraints as possible. But still, I'm not sure about the message that it sends at this point of the ability to be able to do that. But hopefully, you know, fingers crossed that they're able to pull it off without incident.
People are going to be shocked with my answer. I'm going to give it a birdie. And the reason why is over the last couple of weeks, I've kind of learned to accept that I actually believe that this is probably what we're sitting in right now is our new normal, and that we're not going to have the crowds we're used to for at least a couple more years. So Texas is a state that is going to be looser with their regulations. I'm not trialing this in Florida, so let's trial it in Texas, where they're a little bit, it sounds bad, they are a little bit smarter than Florida. let's give it a shot. Wow. I think based on the regulations, someone's got to be the first one to do it. I miss the fans if it's done the right way, and they're doing it at 2,000. The other day I was watching a football game that had 20,000 people in it. That's a quad, right? Like that's an awful idea. This was a much smarter way. We got to try something different. Hopefully everything goes well. I'm giving it a birdie. We have three more. The ShopRite LPGA and the SAS Championship have the same trophy. Is that a birdie or a bogey for you?
I showed Gavin this photo yesterday.
I saw Scott's post on that or photo on that, and I laughed so hard. I got to go bogey. I mean, that's just somebody's got to do some research there.
That's a double for me. I mean, if you're a tournament director, both of those tournaments, at least I know the LPGA one has had that trophy for a little while. I'm not sure about the SAS or SAS one, but certainly, yeah, you got to look around, try to get something unique, try to get something that's not the stock item off the shelf at the trophy house around the corner. It's kind of embarrassing actually for the tournament director. I mean, you spend all this money doing an event. I mean, millions of dollars go into this event. Thousands are going into the trophy, maybe. But yeah, at least get something unique to really honor your winner.
This is a birdie for me because
the level
of not giving a blank to not even try here is so low. It's so low that like you have to be not trying to screw up this badly. Like we talk about bad trophies on this podcast, the Bermuda one where it's literally just a triangle being our one that we talk. Like I'm giving this guy a birdie, this lad, this lady, whoever did it. It's hilarious. And we're talking about it. So it's a birdie for me. I'm all about the content. All right, two more. So birdie or bogey, people buying golf equipment exclusively based on a YouTube review.
Wow.
Exclusively. That's the only thing they see.
This is a really long answer that I can't do. So I'm going to go big time bogey, double bogey for me. We get it all the time where people say, you know, my buddy uses this club, or somebody told me this shaft is better or whatever it is. And you try to go through a whole explanation that no two swings are the same, and therefore no two shafts, products, heads, whatever it might be, are going to work the same with two players. Scott hits it 50 yards by me. I can't use the same thing that Scott uses. If Scott told me it was the best thing in the world for him on a YouTube video and I listened to it, I'd be crazy. So I'm going to go double bogey.
All right. I'm out of my double bogeys. I wish I had one available because I'd throw it at it. But yeah, we see this very often these days. You know, a lot of people get influenced, obviously, by social media, which is just what happens these days. But if someone is going to exclusively buy a product based on what one person says,
I'm afraid they're going to end up with a wrong fit for sure. And, you know, as Gavin knows, it's very important for the fitting process. And I think YouTube is a starting point. Any other type of social media channel, any type of promotion or anything is a starting point, and that's all it can be from there. If it gets your interest in a product, sure, that's okay, but there's just too much that goes into it as far as the player is concerned, the mechanics of their golf swing, what they do individually. Even two golfers that swing at the exact same speed can be totally different as far as their delivery, so you need different products for those people. So based on that alone, bogey, and I wish I could make it a triple bogey.
Stefan, let me just qualify one thing about my answer, and that is that I do think the YouTube content that's out there is great.
Yeah.
As long as people qualify it as, this is information you're taking, don't take it as gospel that it's for you.
Yeah, I'm trying to, I was listening for once what Scott was saying about, you know, I was trying to make an argument for it being a birdie and that, like, this is where we're going and that, you know, the kids, the youths are using YouTube to learn about things and trying to make an argument. Back in your day, you probably only had one person that actually could have told you if a club was good or not. I can't. I'm trying. I did the calculations. The math didn't work out. So it is a bogey. Definitely don't use just one. I think it's a good idea. I think content, that is the next stage for content. Give a Rick Shields and all those guys out there that are trying to make content on YouTube and sell equipment. Hey, it's a job. They're doing a good job if they are making sales, but definitely still go get fit for them.
I'll throw a props out to the TXG guys. They do amazing.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Totally.
You know, but yeah.
Yeah. Right. And you know what? They do a little bit more detailed process, but even they will admit, and they obviously say, you know, if it's Matt that's hitting it or Ian that's hitting it from TXG or whatever, you know, they qualify it and say, you know, this is the response for this player. A different player could have a totally different result. And they know that, but you're right. That content is great as far as an engagement standpoint, but it's a starting point, not a finishing point.
Absolutely. All right. Last one, and then we'll let you go, Gavin. We really appreciate you coming on. Done great. Four straight bogeys. Let's see if we can get him one birdie on the card. Yeah, I know. It's looking like my scorecards from the weekend. Just bogeys everywhere. All right. The last one, Tyrell Hatton, however you want to say it. He's been playing great golf. He's had even better club tosses of late. Tyrell Hatton's club tosses, are they a birdie or are they a bogey for you?
You see, you're killing me. I love watching him. I love the emotion. I don't like club tossing. And I haven't seen the recent ones, but I've seen some of the past ones. Oh, boy. I do like emotion on the golf course. I'm not a terribly emotional guy when I play, but I do enjoy when guys are emotional. I think they can channel it. If they can channel it correctly, and obviously he does by winning. But I still think it sets the wrong example. I don't think there's anything positive about it. So once again, I'm going to say bogey.
Wow.
I've got to concur with my scramble team partner. It is definitely a bogey for me. I mean, I'm not going to say I've not been guilty of it in the past. I don't do it anymore. I'm better at fist pumps and whatever than throwing clubs. But certainly emotion is great. It's difficult when you start to see a player firing a club all over the place. And there are stories of him losing sponsorships because of this situation where, you know, a sponsor came to watch him play, saw him tossing clubs, said, this is not really our image or whatever. I just think it's a difficult image as a junior coach that the juniors think that all of a sudden a club toss is necessary when a shot doesn't go right. It's golf. It's a hard sport. Shots are not going to go where you want them, guaranteed. That's just the way it is. So emotion's great. Club tossing, I draw the line there.
Make some room for the bogey boys here, because I'm firing through with another birdie.
Oh, no.
Absolutely love the emotion. However, you get one. You get one around. If I see more than one club toss, and I'm telling you, I will give you one every couple rounds. I'll give you a good one. But you got to learn how to do it. And this is why Tyrell is my guy. He's not putting the shafts in a bad position. You got to do a helicopter. You got to know it's going to land flat. None of this spiking it in the ground. And then we got Gavin and his tour reps having to fix it between rounds. you get one around, do it right. emotions. It shows that he's normal, like the rest. Well, I guess not you two. You know, the seniors have learned so much about golf and life that they don't have to. They don't get mad out on the golf course anymore. But us, I'm not young anymore either.
Effin, you don't have to deal with all the warranty calls we get when people say, "Oh, my shaft is broke in the middle of it." And we all say, "Yeah."
No, Gavin, I'm the one calling you. I saying, "Oh, it broke in the middle. He swung too hard." There's a local guy here in this Kingston area that had way too many X flexes break right in the middle of the driver. Never seen it before that or after that. It's a birdie. I just you know. I'm fine with emotion, but make sure you're, I think you guys have good call outs of making sure you're a good example. That being said, Gavin, thank you for joining us on Birdie or Bogey. Thank you for joining us on the Tee Talk podcast. Any final thoughts before we wrap things up?
Well, first of all, Stefan, I will say that I listen to you in the birdies and bogeys things every week, and I always disagree with you, and I always wish I was on the phone. And this time I'm disagreeing with you. I feel bad that I disagree because I think your answers were better than mine.
They were.
No answer for you.
That's fair.
You know what? This has been a blast, guys. You guys have a great show. By the way, Scott was a beast last Sunday, and we played in a scramble together, and Scott carried us to a victory. And I got to give props to him because Scott, you were awesome. And you know what? This has been a total pleasure to be with you guys. You guys do a great job. You put on a great show, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to be on the show.
Thank you, Gavin. We appreciate it. I'm just wondering, was my vanity cap of a 6 not good enough for the call for your third in that scramble?
Talk to your partner.
Okay. We'll end it
there.
Thanks, Gav.
We'll see you on the weekend.
Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you, Gavin, for that interview. We really appreciate that. As you can tell, this is a guy we'll have on anytime. He loved coming on, and it was nice bringing back Bogey versus Birdie with a guest. 5 straight bogeys. It's like my golf rounds on the weekend, man. It was very similar. Just that.
I guess it's all about the questions, really, more than anything. But you know, it's a great way to at least address a topic or two. That's for sure.
Yeah, I think we need to make these more difficult, where it's actually hard to pick a side. I tried to argue the one side on one of them. I couldn't find a way to make it work, and I was the only one disagreeing with you guys on any of them. And it was nice to have Gavin disagree with me, though.
We might have to do that sometime, where we have to automatically take the opposite and try to argue the point.
I like that. That's another good game that I'm all for.
That's like a grade 9 debate thing. You got to take the other side.
I'm all for it. So. That being said, we have a new segment.
Yeah.
And this new segment, there is no taking another side. This new segment, I came up with on my own. And I had to explain to our senior citizen here in Scott McLeod how this works. It's called Correct Opinions, in our opinion. I'm not going to lie. It's stolen. There's a podcast out there, I believe, exactly called this. And I just completely stole it from that. But the idea behind it is we're going to have a topic. How it's going to work is Scott and I are each going to bring one topic to the podcast, and we're going to give the correct opinion on the topic in our opinion. The other side cannot argue against it at all. They just have to nod. They can ask questions, but they cannot argue against it. They can't give their opinion on it. They just got to take it for what it is and accept that that is the correct opinion. So we're each going to give one, and then we're each going to give somebody else another one, each other another one, and we're going to have to make the correct opinion, in our opinion, on that topic. Do you understand the purpose of this segment?
I'm going to try. And if anybody doesn't understand this segment, send your messages to Stefan Nummy.
Yeah, so that's at Steedorf on Twitter. I will take your DMs and any Scotch advice you have. All right, so I'll go first. This is my segment. Sure. I came up with it. You hated it from the beginning. I'm making you do it.
I didn't hate it. I just didn't understand it.
Yeah. Opinions are just that. Scott, I don't care. It's not supposed to make sense. It's a podcast. Get over it. All right. So the question that I'm going to give the correct opinion on is, what is the correct opinion on golf courses having dress codes? And here's the correct opinion. Dress codes are stupid. And if you make a dress code that is so hard that if the average person coming into your golf club, even if they have regular golf stuff, still aren't meeting it, it's even stupider. Stupider is not even a word. And what got me on this thought process of it is I saw this golf course with a dress code out of Australia that your socks couldn't have a logo on them. Not only that, you couldn't have anklet socks or mid-knee socks. There's like a 6-inch window of sock surface area. Those are three words in a row that I've never used in my life that you must fit to be able to play this golf course. That is ridiculous. What is the point? What value are you bringing? If I'm sitting on the patio at the golf course after my round of golf, do I really look over and be like, oh, that person's, their outfit meets my standards, so I feel bad? Like, I don't get the point. The point doesn't make sense. The only reason you're doing it is because you feel bad about yourself. Your club isn't great enough on its own with its own design that you need to have such a crazy dress code that people will feel that it's so elite to even be honored, an honor to be there. If you actually feel like it has to be an honor for you to be at your golf course, you're in the wrong mindset. And if you need a dress code to address that, that's on you. You need to look at yourself in the mirror and ask, why are we doing this? Dress codes are silly. I get having small ones in the sense of like, hey, you can't have jeans on the golf course. Small. But if it is literally...
You're arguing against yourself.
You can ask questions. You know the rules. You know the rules. Small ones. But if I have to look at myself up and down in the mirror twice before I even get to your golf course, your dress code's too intense, stop it. It's silly. Done. You have one question.
My one question is, if they are a private club and they determine their rules and everybody wants to agree to that, why are they not free to set their own rules?
They are. That's not the question. The question is, what is the correct opinion on golf courses having dress codes? You can set your dress code. The correct opinion, it's stupid that you have one. That is the correct opinion. I don't get the value of it. There is no value of it. You know what? I'm going to let you have one counter. What is the value of a dress code?
The value of a dress code, and again, I'm not trying to argue against you. I'm just saying the value of a dress code is setting a minimum standard for what is acceptable within your environment.
Is a minimum standard value?
Well,
when you go to a restaurant, Scotty, and you go, I'm paying top prices for this, I would actually just like you to give me the minimum quality of the dish I am ordering. Not the best, not the worst. I just want the minimum that you find acceptable. Is that a valuable spend of your dollar?
Well, I will say this without arguing against you. If you work for a certain corporation and you go to a meeting for said corporation, and they say to you that the outfit that you're wearing is not acceptable to be in the meeting for that corporation, how is that different than a golf course?
That's also stupid. It's the point I'm trying to make. And I work for another company outside this podcast that I have worn a sweatshirt basically to a meeting with our CEO who is wearing no shoes. And guess what? That company is the most valuable company in Canada. So we don't need a dress code to actually be successful. And that's what I'm trying to get at, is that it brings no value. It's old school thinking. It's not the world we live in anymore. That is the end. That is the correct opinion. If your course has a dress code, rethink why we have it. I want you to look at it and ask yourself why five times before you go any further. Scott, it is now your turn.
We're going to have to go back to our Jeremy Taggart, our podcast where we had him as a guest, where we talked about golf courses and wild names, and the one was a nudist golf course. And then we'll talk about dress codes even more. Anyways,
sure,
next.
Sure.
We'll on to the next one. All right. What is the correct opinion about the best way to play golf being to hit fairways and greens? So here's what I'm saying. I see it all the time. I see people talking and they talk about, you know, you have to hit fairways and greens. This is the way you play. This is the way you play golf. This is the proper way to play golf. What I'm here to say to anyone, the proper way to play golf is to get the lowest score. That is the goal. The goal is not to go out and hit the number of fairways. The goal is not to hit the number of the greens. The goal is to have the lowest score. And I will tell you, from statistics, when you look at it, not necessarily does a player hitting fairways and greens score the best always. It can be an indicator, but I'll tell you what, you can go out and hit 18 greens, but if you hit it 40 feet away from the hole, you're probably not going to score that well, and your putts in regulation or your putts per green are not going to be that great. The point is, there's no right way to play. The right way to play is to get the golf ball in the hole as quickly as possible. There are ways to go about doing that, but it's not by playing proper golf. And I've had that. I've had people say that, well, that person doesn't play the game properly. Just because they bash it out there, lob a wedge up there and make a putt, they just say, oh, that's just looks stupid. So that is the correct opinion, in my opinion.
I have my one question.
Sure.
Do you believe, as a coach, it's important to track your stats?
I believe it is important to track proper stats. I think some people all of a sudden are fooled by some stats. I would rather have proximity to the hole, because I can have two players that both hit 14 out of 18 greens, but if the one person is hitting it 50 feet away from the hole, that is not equal to the person that is hitting it 10 feet away from the hole. So statistics can lie. They have to be interpreted properly. So keeping the right statistics is important, more than just keeping statistics.
That's my final question. I'm only allowed one. All right.
There you go.
There's a great correct opinion. See, you like this. You're enjoying this.
I'll try.
This is a great segment. It's your favorite segment. That is the correct opinion of your opinion. All right. So the next part of this is we're each going to give each other a topic. We didn't prepare this. So, Scott, I'll let you go first since you just talked for a little bit. You probably need to catch your breath. What correct opinion do you need from me on what topic?
All right. As a 31-year-old, a newly 31-year-old, you obviously represent a different generation than me at 50. And I look at how golf courses are structured and how things are done in the past, be it private clubs, public clubs, whatever. But in the case of private golf clubs, what is the correct opinion on private golf clubs having a large initiation fee?
There's probably, how many episodes? We're on episode 88. I would say there's at least 20 episodes where I've addressed this. And the correct opinion is initiation fees are old school and they're dumb and they should be gone with the way of dress codes. I get you're a private club, but why am I paying an initiation fee? And that is the key thing. Is I want to address. If you're not giving me the why in the first place of paying the initiation fee, then it's ridiculous. If you give me the why off the bat, hey, you like my golf course. It's a great golf course. Here's what it costs to pay at all. Play all year.
And I'm saying an initiation fee. I'm not talking about buying a share.
No,
that's a pure initiation fee. Yeah,
that is different. So if you're giving me that. So I have my one cost. Here's how much it takes to pay to play each year. Here's how much it takes to just be on the membership. You just pay this and it goes away. If I don't get my why of where all this money goes to, how it improves my experience as a member year in and year out, and how they plan to invest my initiation fee, which is different than my paying to play the golf course fees, then it's awful. It's clear that I might not be built for private golf, based on my first two correct opinions here. But I think not getting
that phone call from Augusta National anytime soon.
I don't think I am, but I think that's the key. Where my head is at in business these days is if you don't know why you're doing something, then you're doing it wrong. Every single thing you need to be doing in business, and golf is a business, it's an entertainment business. If you don't have the why behind it, you don't know what you're even doing there. You could make it, if it's $4,000, you can make it $30,000 because you don't even know why you're doing it in the first place. So you may as well just throw more money on there to get more money in your golf club and make your CEO make more money, because you don't even know why you're charging in the first place. So I think the correct, sorry, hold on. I don't think I know. I know the correct opinion is initiation fees should not exist. Make your cost of your golf course, the what you charge per round higher, what your membership is per round higher. If you need it to go back into the golf club, put it all together. But an initiation fee that I got to pay $10,000 just to even pay more money per month to even play your golf course. It's ridiculous. It's old school. Should be gone with the way of the dress code. That is the correct opinion. Questions?
No, no question. Good enough for me.
That's good. All right. So, Scott, I need one more from you. The correct opinion. As a 50-year-old, you are 50. Now I see why my age got brought up. What is the correct opinion on the state of Phil Mickelson's game?
If I actually look and drill down on Phil's game, I think a lot of people have a perception of it based on things they see on social media from a marketing standpoint. Obviously, there's a lot of things that Phil is doing from an engagement standpoint right now that I think actually disguise how he is playing, and I'll get to that in a second. I think on the other side of that is when you get to broadcasts, they tend to pay attention to Phil a fair bit. And when they do, they tend to go towards shots that are favorable, things that he's doing well. Maybe it's driving off the tee and they're comparing it of, oh, he's, you know, got the same ball speed as the 30-year-old. But I don't think, even though he's just won two times on the Champions Tour, with, I will say, the announcers cheering him on more than they were Mike Weir, I guarantee you they could not cheer any harder for Phil to get that second victory. But I think if you look at in relative to the PGA Tour, if I look at his 2020 season, despite the fact that he did have a T2 at FedEx St. Jude, his only other top finish was a third at Pebble Beach Pro-Am. I'm sorry, Capital One's The Match Champions for Charity T3 does not count. Otherwise, he had a bunch of cuts, a lot of top 50s, more cuts, missed cuts more than anything. I really don't think, I think there's a lot of smoke and mirrors about it that he's not really playing as well as people think he is. Although, you know, getting it done on the Champions Tour, but getting it done on the Champions Tour is, you know, that's a major league player in a minor league park. Really, that's what it amounts to. And as I mentioned earlier, he's got some skills that are maybe a little bit better and a little bit more polished than some of those players at that level. But I don't think when you put it in relationship to the regular tour, he's not going to go out there and win 10 more events on the regular tour. It's not going to happen. So no disrespect, great champion, 44-time winner, but he missed a lot of cuts in 2020.
I have one question. Is he a Champions Tour player or is he a PGA Tour player? You cannot pick both.
I think at this point he is a Champions Tour player. I really do. If you're going to be a player who's a professional golfer and your goal in professional golf is to go out and win the most money. So even relative to the purses that are on the PGA Tour, he is going to put the smackdown on the guys on the PGA Champions Tour more often than he is on the regular tour. He's going to cash in there. Despite, you know, your ego saying, hey, you know what, I want to mix it up with the young guys still, at some point he's just going to have to admit to himself that, hey, let's go on a run, let's just play everything and be the best player ever, let's chase down the records of Hale Irwin and all the other players, Bernhard Langer, Jimenez, all these guys that win all the time, go head to head against those guys all the time, get your wins, rack them up, and you know what, nobody's going to think anything worse of him. As I said, 5-time major champion, 44-time winner on the PGA Tour. He's just going to continue his legacy on the PGA Tour champions.
No further questions, Your Honor. That was correct opinions. Now, Scott, final correct opinion. What is the correct opinion on this segment?
I think we just got to tighten it up. It's a little lengthy as far as what we're doing, but I like the concept. I think it's interesting because I think, you know, everybody's got opinions on those things. They have opinions that they believe are correct, or we think is the only opinion on that. So I think it generally will lead to some conversations, which is always important.
That is important. It's funny though, because we actually had this segment always here. It was just called the mailbag, where people ask questions and we just gave our opinions on it, which we thought were correct anyway. But I like this segment. I think it's a great segment. It will continue maybe every once in a while. Send in, I'm going to say once a month. Every four episodes, Scott's going to throw out a tweet that says, correct opinions is back. What is the correct opinion you want to hear from Stefan? What is the correct opinion you want to hear from Scott? You're going to give it to us, and we're going to pick the best ones of both. We're going to give that to you for every 4 weeks. You like that? Are you in for that? Can sure. I get yeah. you to commit to every 4 weeks to this segment that you didn't want to do once?
That is the correct opinion.
All right. All right. Well, we have more opinions coming up as we have the mailbag. We're going to grab a quick break, and we will be back with your questions and our opinions.
All right, welcome back. This is the mailbag where we take your questions and answer them, give our opinions, our expertise to your questions.
Not the correct opinion.
Not the correct opinion.
Our opinions.
Yeah. Our opinion for sure. So we appreciate you sending them in. They came in fast and hard this week, and we got some great ones. So looking forward to getting through them. All right, let's get going here. How many years should I have a driver before I consider an upgrade? Mine was fitted a couple years ago. I think we've had some themes of that before, but any other latest opinions on that?
Yeah, go every 3 years and just test it, compare it to something new. If a fitter can't beat it every 3 years, then either A, you were perfectly fit for it that time, or they're not doing their job. So a club comparison with a fitting kind of involved isn't that much money, depending where you go. So I'd say every 3 years, the technology actually changes relatively decently. So that's my thoughts. What about you?
Yeah, product cycles now are, they can vary within the companies. A lot are trying to go to more towards 2 years, but we see, a year sometimes with drivers. But I like what you're talking about there. Don't always think about the fact that, is it time to buy a new driver? I'm committed. Here's my money. I have to go do it. Commit to the fitting. And as you said, take the product that you've got, go and try out the products that are there. See if you can get a fitting to tweak it and make it better. Make it, is it enough value to make that update? So if all of a sudden you go there and you're getting it, 2 yards further and it's going to cost you $750, that's up to you as far as the value proposition, whether maybe you like the look better, maybe you like the feel better, maybe there's something else about it besides just, distance, because that shouldn't be the only factor that's involved there. So I like that sort of same cycle, probably similar, I'd say 4 years, kind of two generations within maybe a brand or a company, but don't be afraid to dive in every now and then and just, pay out for a fitting, go do some testing. And if you think something might be better for a particular reason, and like I said, it doesn't necessarily have to be distance, could be sound, could be feel, could be look, could be forgiveness off center, go in and make that happen. So yeah, I'm 4 years.
Cool.
All right. On to the next one here. What's the best thing you have spent money on in golf? I really like this one, actually. I put this one out on Twitter as well, and I got some neat responses back from people, but it certainly had me thinking.
Yeah, this definitely has me thinking. And, I have a putter that I've had for a long time, a Scotty Cameron Coronado. I drove an hour and a half to go get it. It was a great price, but it sounds silly, but I have a few St. Andrews ball markers that anytime I even look at them, I just remember that day I spent there. I'd even play the golf course. I ended up playing the ladies putting club at St. Awesome. Andrews and just walked the golf course. I had two great meals and two great pubs and went to the R&A Hall of Fame. It was just a cool day.
The British Open Museum, yeah.
And anytime I don't bring it out every single round, the ball marker, because I want to remember it when I do and think about it. But that ball, like for me, ball markers are what's at. I have so many hats and things from all over and drivers and hybrids and clubs come and go for me with technology. I have a couple putters that will just never leave, they just won't be sold. But even at that point, they still probably have a price. Like these ball markers, they're just cool memento for me. So yeah. That's what I'm going to go with right now. What about you? What's the one that that got you thinking? Because you got you got 20 more years of the industry.
Yeah, I mean, I've played the game for 40 years and been fortunate enough to travel, you know, pretty much a lot of places around the world, do a lot of great things in the game. And, you know, I certainly spend some money on that. It's not a case of, you know, getting freebies all over the place or whatever. But, you know, there's certain things that you like. And as you say, you've got a memento there that means something to you. So we're not talking here about, you know, spending the most money. You know, it could be something as small as a ball marker and making it significant. But, you know, I started to think about it. And, you know, I was a guy who grew up and didn't have access to a golf professional early on. And I wasn't able to take lessons. I had to learn on my own because I was living in some isolated places. So we didn't have a PGA pro. And, you know, so I worked on my game and I've done different seminars and things over the years. But a few years ago, I went with another pro friend of mine and a student, and I spent the money to go down and get a putting lesson, of all things, with John Graham, who I've mentioned in this podcast, who works with, you know, tons of PGA Tour players. And you know, he was down, he lives in the Rochester area, and spent the money to go down, spend part of a day with him and kind of look at that part of my game, which I really hadn't had someone look at it deeply before. And, you know, I learned so much in just a short period of time because he's had so much wisdom, and, you know, it changed how I play the game. And it changed a lot for me, not just scoring wise, but just confidence wise. And it brought a lot of enjoyment to me. So, you know, when I thought about it, as far as investing, you know, it was the best money I ever spent. And I'm not saying, you know, everybody has to go out and, you know, get a lesson with a coach or whatever.
Everyone
that's not
needs to see John Graham.
Yeah, that's not what I'm pushing here or whatever. But, you know, just a brilliant guy, well worth the money. And, you know, it really changed how I looked at that part of the game. It enhanced what I do in my game as a professional, but it also enhanced me as a coach as well, and how I approach putting and doing stuff with students as well. So I think the benefit was not only for me, but for other people as well.
Awesome.
All right, on to three here. Any stories from playing with really bad golfers over the years? Oh my, this one! Wow, we could be on here for hours.
Yeah, let's narrow it down to our favorite. So I have a buddy, sure. one of my greatest friends, just an all around amazing dude, and he's great to play golf with, because if he has a 9 in his scorecard, he's elated. He's so happy. So. I think I may have told this on the podcast before, but I'm going to tell you again. So he, par 5, hit a good drive. He grabs his 3-wood, and he takes a full swing, and he's looking. He's like, I don't know where that went. And as he's looking over at me, he looks at me directly in the eye. I don't know where that went. It lands on top of his head. He has topped this ball so hard that it popped directly straight up in the air, that it landed directly on his head and landed beside him. That is easily the most I've laughed on the golf course. It's a memory I'm going to cherish for the rest of my life, because I'm never, ever going to see it again.
No.
And the best part about it, later on in that round of golf, he swung full speed at a driver and it went straight up in the air, not that high, that he just caught it in his hand and said, that doesn't count, put it back on the tee, and then straight down the middle of the fairway. So those, he can get into the 90s when he struggles. He's generally kind of a 100 to 110 guy. But if you said, hey, you're golfing with my buddy Dan every day of the week, I'm out there with him, because he's just the same guy every day. And these are the type of stories you get when you play with him.
That's pretty cool. I mean, I've obviously seen some bad shots and stuff over the years. I would say of someone that I've been playing with, though, again, you know, there's been certainly a lot of them. And again, I might be this might be a story that I've told before. At least I think I've told you, but I'm not sure on the podcast. But I happened to be playing in a media day one time with a PR director for a corporation, and their corporation happened to sponsor this LPGA event. And this guy that I was playing with, I would say, you know, we'll talk. He was a very athletic guy. He could create a lot of club head speed. As a golfer, though, not very skilled at all. In fact, he was so poorly skilled that because he could swing super, super fast, but his club would bury into the ground or whatever, or his contact was so poor, that when he hit a good shot, it went crazy distances. So, you know, if I had a 5-iron that went X distance, he might hit it 30 yards past that. Like, he, I mean,
and
he
hit
this
it
guy,
long. You do, yeah, hit so it long.
So this guy really, really moved it. So we get to the ninth hole of this golf course that's going to host an LPGA event. He goes to hit his approach, and he's probably, I don't know, he might have been 150 yards from the green. Now, the clubhouse is about 50 yards behind this green.
Probably more if you really actually think about it.
But yeah, yeah. It could be more. And not only was it the clubhouse, it was their curling rink, which had sort of a, you know, a canted roof as far as a A-frame type thing or whatever. So he had hit progressively terrible shots going down this hole over and over again, obviously anticipating that he wasn't going to have any success. You know, he probably took a lot of club because he thought, oh, I'm going to miss hit this and this will get to the green. It was way too much club. Way too much club. I mean, this thing was probably 70 feet in the air when it cleared the green, ended up going onto the roof of the clubhouse, rolled along the roof of the clubhouse, which was a curling club, kept going along the roof side, ended up coming down on their second floor patio, which is probably located about 60 yards left of the green. And this guy was definitely on his way to shooting about 250 that day. But that said, like your buddy, he knew he was terrible. All he could do was laugh. And we laughed about it too. And we just thought, you know what? Great guy. I just don't think I ever want to play golf with him again because he might kill somebody.
No, Dan's not shooting 250. However, your guy there, he didn't hit himself in the head. And that's
true. That's good point.
Almost broke a few windows, though.
Three of them left here. Looking for top quality gear for crap weather, which is obviously what we get this time of year in Canada. You get in the Northeast US as well. Already snowing in some parts here in North America. Who makes the best stuff? Probably in our opinion.
I'm going to let you take an actual answer at this and say that if anybody out there, any companies want to prove me wrong, send me some gear, I'm all for it. That being said, I'm pretty sure you could go to anywhere, Value Village, anywhere, and find some rain pants and a raincoat. That's gonna be just fine. And it might not be something you see out on tour, but I've legit never owned rain pants. Probably a bad thing. I've had a couple rain jackets from golf companies. They're fine. But lately I've been throwing on my old K-Way. Yeah. Whoa. You probably wore it as a kid.
Whoa.
Folds up into a fanny pack if you need it. My old K-Way orange rain jacket on the golf course when needed, and stays dry. So, hey, FootJoy, Levelwear, whoever, Adidas out there, you want me to wear your stuff, I will. I'll try it out. But right now, I'm a K-Way guy.
Wow. You can go other brands outside of the golf sphere. You know, you can look at stuff from, you know, Helly Hansen and stuff like that. But, you know, within golf itself, particularly FootJoy makes some tremendous products. They certainly do. I've got a couple of their jackets that, have done well for me playing overseas in tremendously poor weather. Galvin Green makes some amazing stuff. They have some Japanese grade, super lightweight Gore-Tex stuff. And again, you know, we're not talking lightweight stuff here. We're talking, you know, super, well, I'll say lightweight as far as product, not lightweight when it comes to price. So we're talking about jackets that are all of a sudden in the $600 US range. So if this question is coming from somebody who's got no limits and we're going top quality, some of the Gore-Tex that Galvin Green does is incredible as far as wear. You had a question.
I saw a vest the other day that it was a vest. It looked like you were going duck hunting in it. It was blue and brown. It had a price tag of $260 on it. I'm not going to name the brand, but the brand was even like anywhere on it. Can you imagine? Like, hey, I'm not a guy that's about vanity, but can you imagine spending $260 on a vest and then not even be able to say, hey, this is the brand it is? Like, if I'm spending that much money, I want people to actually know what brand I'm wearing. But it's not going to keep you more warm than Old Navy is. That's the problem I have with stuff like that.
I think the issue more than anything comes down to, I mean, you're right. You know, you can throw something on K-Way or whatever the case may be. Where it really pays off is if you're out there for a long period of time, and maybe on a trip as well, where, you know, it's something that's got to dry out as soon as possible and not something that you've got, you know, you just play one time and you're not going to play for another week and you've got the time to hang and dry it. But, you know, when you get into the super high expensive, high quality stuff, that's the kind of things that you get out of there. You also get stuff that's you can also wear during warm weather conditions. That's the one thing as well, is that if you end up with rain gear that's too warm and you got a sunny day but a lot of rain, you know, you're sweating out there and it's not that comfortable. Whereas you can see some of the lightweight rain gear that is still protective as far as you know, keeping the water off you. It's going to cost you to get into that. So I would say, yeah, FootJoy, Galvin Green, a couple of the top brands. Sun Mountain makes some great stuff. Lots of good stuff out there. But again, it really comes down to how long you're going to use it, how much rain you're going to be in, and how much you are willing to pay. All right, two more. Have you ever bought a golf club because a pro was playing it?
Nope.
Are you sure about that?
Yep.
Never been influenced by one?
No. I'm not gonna lie. No, like, I really haven't. I'm trying hard to think. No, yeah. I really haven't. There's brands I love because of what they stand for and things. No.
Yeah. You know what? I thought about this one too. And you know what? Again, I've been fortunate. I was in the, you know, retail business for quite some time and things like that. So I get access to equipment and things, but you know, even when I thought back of my junior years, I didn't buy, maybe a set from a particular pro. I may have got a set because of, you know, it was a style that was being played. So for an example, you know, Wilson blades, staff blades, because a lot of players played them, you know, in a certain era. So that influenced me to kind of look at them and put them in the bag. But it wasn't because of a hero worship where all of a sudden it was like, oh, well, Greg Norman plays the, you know, Tour Edition Persimmon. I want to have that in my bag. That's never been the case for me. So yeah, I'm sort of the same. It you know, although there's some brand influence, there's never really been a particular club influence where I've had to say, you know, I want that club because that pro is playing it.
I'll give you brand influence, but definitely not club. Yeah. I would say there's one club where I would play because they played it. It's Tiger Woods' regular Scotty Cameron putter that he uses. If you gave me my hand on that, absolutely I'm playing it. It's just, yeah. But no.
Interesting though. And it'd be interesting to know, you know, if you're a listener to this, I mean, you know, drop it on our Twitter and let us know if there's been a golf club that you bought because of a particular pro. I'd be really interested to hear that.
I'm just trying to think of one where, like, because of particular pro, sales went up higher. I'm thinking probably because of Tiger.
Oh yeah,
like those old Nike Sasquatch drivers that, like, you know,
the,
like,
the King Cobra driver King when he Cobras. Played his first thing. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's certainly been clubs. You know, Fred Couples, the 588 Cleveland wedges. A lot of people all of a sudden wanted to play those. You know, shoes, Echo shoes when he was playing them. True. People wanted to play them. John Daly with the Cobra brand. I mean, that Cobra Ultra Mid driver that he won at Crooked Stick with in 1991. That, you know, we couldn't get enough of those to sell them back then. So it certainly affects consumers in a certain way. Does it affect everybody? No. Do those consumers certainly find out that maybe the club's not suited them? Yes. But you know, if they want to buy it, they buy it. But it's never been the case for me. All right, last one here. This one actually came in from a guy I know who is an architect, but he says, does hitting the golf ball further help the average golfer in the pace of play, given that further also means further offline? I can't decide, is what he said, which I'm skeptical. I think he has decided, but I know he's probably listening to this podcast, so I'll be interested to find out if he's actually just kind of throwing the question out to hear if we agree with him or not.
You would really like our previous segment. It was called Correct Opinions. I came up with that on exactly. My own. Yeah. My Correct Opinion's the best segment we've ever had. I'm not sure.
Weird. I think those two things are actually working against each other. I mean, you know, it's two different questions. Does hitting the golf ball further help the average golfer and the pace of play? I mean, those can be two separate issues. That's for sure. You know, I think hitting the ball further, helping the average golfer. I mean, the average golfer with TrackMan stats, we look at the average male golfer is only hitting at 214 yards.
Yeah.
So I would have to assume that if all of a sudden they were hitting it 15 yards further, even if he is a little bit offline,
right? They're not going to be that far offline. And going back to my correct opinion, they don't necessarily have to be in the fairway, although it could be helpful, but it's going to put less club in their bag. Does that mean they're going to play slower? I mean, it's not like they're all of a sudden going to hit it 60 yards further, you know, but 10 or 15 yards further, one club, is that going to slow them down because they have to wait for a, you know, to go for a green or for a fairway to clear? No, I don't think so. And I think if we're starting to talk about guys that hit it, you know, 270, 280, 290, we're now talking about a small percentage of the players, not the wide scope of players that are out there playing your average golf courses.
100%. And everything, it's not how far you hit it or how good you are that makes you slow. I think we've talked about that so many times on this podcast. Patrick Cantlay, I hate to break it to you, if you played with him in a regular round outside of he's slow. He's just slow, yeah. Right? Yeah. And you know, Marge, who you play with in your Sunday, you got paired up with her. She might be fast because she literally just gets the ball and hits it, and she might be faster than Patrick Cantlay. And Patrick might hit her 155 yards past her.
Yeah,
that's probably even generous.
I think it's a small factor. I think it's the, you know, what we're just saying and we've talked about before. It's about being prepared to play, having some purpose in your playing, not standing around and wasting time or whatever. That has more to do with it than distance. So 100%. Sorry to this architect who sent it in, but I don't think it's that big of an issue. And I guess we can talk about it outside the podcast.
100%. All right. Well, that is it from the mailbag, I believe.
Yeah.
Thank you for sending your questions in. Scott opens that up every single week. These are great questions. 6 questions. We filled up quick this week, so make sure you get those in. And look out for the correct opinions mailbag coming in about 4 weeks' time, which I can't wait to see that. Before we wrap it up, every single week, Scotty gives us the tip of the week. Scotty, winter is coming. What can we work on in the winter? You know, like, is this a good time to learn about different shot shapes and different ways we can play the ball? What are your thoughts about how we can improve our game over the next couple months?
Well, you know what? We're going to get deep into the winter stuff in the next little while, and I'll have a lot to do with that. But I think we've still got a little bit of time left to play here. But it's certainly a time of year where flighting shots becomes very important. And, you know, our guest that was on there, I played with Gavin on the weekend, and we played in a scramble tournament where the winds were, you know, 50 kilometers, gusting to 70 kilometers. So flighting shots became very important. And, you know, one thing that I would see a lot of times when players go out and try to flight shots, and when I say by flight shots, keeping the trajectory down, but having it effective as far as the shot is concerned, a lot of them are trying to, you know, reduce the dynamic loft, right? And they try to keep the loft off the club to keep the shot down, but a lot of them do it in an incorrect way. What they tend to do sometimes is they try to hit down a little bit more on the golf ball. Well, in fact, all you're doing is you're moving the same amount of loft, you know, downward, but the angle of attack just basically goes downward as well. So it doesn't really reduce the spin. The issue that happens is that when players really try to do that, they tend to lean their hands forward a lot. And what you end up doing is you take the effective bounce off the club. And especially in soft conditions this time of year, they try to hit these flighted shots. Next thing you know, they just hit these big old divots because they catch the club fat in behind it. And the leading edge digs into the ground and they don't get a really effective shot because the club really never gets the ball as well as it should. So what people should really do is focus less on hitting down, try to keep the shot shallow, but certainly take a lot more club and then just make a more shallow swing as you go through, not trying to dig down. Use that loft to flight the shot down, not so much of trying to hit down as much. And what you'll find is that you're going to get some shots that have less spin on them, work their way through the wind, you know, go a little bit lower, and then achieve the result that you want, even in the high winds.
I like that. I think there's a lot of technical stuff you're talking there, which... In my opinion, the best time to get technical on your golf swing is now in the winter, throughout the winter months. So if you have been waiting for lessons, you're like, hey, I just want to play golf through this year, this is the time. Talk to your local professional. Find one. If you are even unsure, hey, I live here, who would you recommend?
Sure.
Tweet at Flagstick. They will, Scott will find you somebody that he recommends in that area. They will have a winter program for you. And this is where we can get really technical with the game.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you know, I've got a golf tip on that this week up at flagstick.com talking about the different cycles of training and what you need to do. And you're right, exactly it. This is a time where, you know, during the season when you're trying to play, it's, as you know, it's very hard to dig deep into the technical aspects of the game because you're still trying to get results out of it. So this is the time where maybe you have a little bit of break after the season, you assess what your goals are, see where you want to go with things, and then start to work on the big technique changes, the big pieces, and then you can work towards pre-tournament and tournament play back in the springtime. But, you know, don't wait. I mean, the worst thing that could happen, I've said this on the show before, is the golf season opens on April 15th and you're looking for that lesson on April 7th. It's not going to happen. You're not going to make that big change in your game. You're just going to show up with the same thing that you had when you put the clubs away earlier in the year previous. So yeah, definitely technical aspects of it. Good time to work on it. And yeah, feel free to pass on any of your questions regarding that. PGA of Canada's got a great directory as well. PGA of America as well. And certainly we can guide you towards some great pros that you can work with in your area.
100%. Well, that's it for the podcast this week. Thank you, Gavin, for coming on. We appreciate that. Scotty, thank you for giving your best in the correct opinions segment. I know you didn't want to do it, but I know you appreciate it, and you're learning to love it, and I can't wait to do it again. For me, Loopers is on TV on the Golf Channel right now. If it's on TV, I'm going to go watch it and learn about the caddies back in old Tom Morris's days up to the caddies now. It's a great movie. If you haven't watched it yet, you got to go out and watch it. Find it on Golf Channel. Probably every, like, almost every 4 weeks it's on there. If you can't find it on there, you can find it online somewhere. Thank you for listening, though, folks. We really, really appreciate it. We thank you for sending in your mailbag questions. Scott, any final thoughts on the episode as a whole?
No, loved it. Had a lot of fun. Gavin was a great guest. Lots of great topics this week. And you know what? I'm excited. I mean, we're here in October and we're still talking about a lot of golf. We've got a men's major. We got a women's major left to play still. That's exciting. So we're going to have a lot of great guests during the wintertime. And I really appreciate the 31-year-old Stefan Tiedorf joining us on the show for a chat. You're getting older there, bud, but you're getting better.
Getting older, getting balder. If you do make any money off of our Masters predictions, our bets, however, we do actually appreciate gifts. We don't want money. We just want gifts. Scott and I like scotch, as you heard. So whatever you feels appropriate. We're not gonna push you into a corner or anything, but maybe we should throw some actual money down and see how that goes this Masters. Maybe we'll talk about that later. You know what I said, this movie's on. I gotta go, man. I gotta go watch Loopers. I appreciate everyone for listening. Scotty, on behalf of both of us, thank you for subscribing. Thank you for being here every single week. We're having a blast doing this. We can't wait for 88 more episodes. So until next week, thank you for listening. We'll chat with you then. Slow motion in the daylight. Today my boat's lost in the ocean. Have a